It's 8:10 in sports. In the NBA, the Bucks won their 12th straight with a 132-88 rout of the Knicks. The Brewers declined to offer contracts to Travis Shaw, Jimmy Nelson, and three others, making them free agents. Pitchers Alex Claudio and Junior Guerrero and infielder Tyler Saladino were also released by the Brewers club that's parted with a number of key players this offseason. The Seahawks did the Packers a favor last night, knocking off the Vikings 37-30. Now, the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Cloudy skies through mid-morning, then gradual clearing, a high near 40, west winds at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Partly cloudy tonight, a low around 29. Then for tomorrow, partly sunny, a high of 37. Right now, we have a temperature reading of 31 degrees with cloudy skies. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I am so pleased to be able to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Seer, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, Director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War, and a columnist whose work appears in newspapers across the country, including the Kenosha News, on a regular basis. And we're happy to have him as a regular guest to the morning show to offer his perspective on a wide array of questions and issues and concerns. Professor Seer, it's great to welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's always very nice to be here, and I really mean that.
Let's talk for just a quick second about a trip that you were on not too long ago with Carthage's mock trial team, taking part in, at some point, I believe it was the mock trial, folks, although maybe not exactly, but
no,
something.
No, it was mock trial and Model UN, two separate trips down to Chicago just before the Thanksgiving holiday.
Great. And we've talked about mock trial before and their great success. Explain to our listeners what the Model UN is all about and why that can be a meaningful experience for the students who participate in it.
Well, the Model UN is just that. It's a simulation or a serious presentation of UN General Assembly, Security Council. General Assembly is the inclusive legislative dimension of our United Nations. Security Council is sort of the executive oversight of the principal powers in the world, as they were mainly at the end of World War II, with some minor modifications, and committee meetings. and it's a very, very large-scale enterprise in this country. Professor Jeff Roberg, our good colleague in political science over a long period of time, has built this program up into a very active one involving a lot of our students. They regularly win awards. We have a high school conference every fall that, again, Jeffrey has built up to a major enterprise. We had over 400 students this fall. President Swallow from our college was kind enough to spend some time greeting them, which we appreciate very much. And they won two awards during a regional competition in Chicago down at the Sheraton Hotel.
So what are they judged on in order to win an award? What are they winning an award for? What skills do they demonstrate?
Presentation skills, knowledge skills, debate skills. It's a good deal less intense than mock trial. They're both extremely valuable and important programs and long-term priorities of our Claussen Center at the college. But the Model UN has a sizable staff, mostly volunteers, faculty and others, and they evaluate these very, very active presentations.
Mm-hmm. So a given student who participates in the Model UN, are they assigned a particular, in a sense, character to play?
You play a country, a character as a country. Excuse me, yeah.
Okay.
And you have some freedom. You don't necessarily get what you want, but you have some freedom in the countries that you ask for. I hope you'll have Jeff Roberg on again soon, along with the student leaders of Model UN. I'm the kindly professor who tags along, but they're the ones who really know it, chapter and verse. And Eisenhower once said, leadership is getting people to do what you want them to do because they want to do it. And the more you think about that, the more you realize that's really profound.
Yeah.
And we're very, very fortunate at all levels of our fine college to have people who are committed to doing what they want to do, which is also beneficial to our students.
Very good. I want to be sure to take a second to, we have other things to get to, but one of your most recent columns,
just mention as well regarding mock trial, it was a double header. I really appreciate you bringing this up. Mike Fegley, like Jeff, he's a practicing attorney who deals with criminal law and family law and other rough areas in Racine, as well as a faculty member at Carthage and a municipal judge in Mount Pleasant. He has built up mock trial. It's an intensely competitive, intensely competitive, courtroom experience. Again, the value is self-evident. Tom Claussen ran the World Bank, which is one of the three economic arms of the United Nations, as you know. And he was also a lawyer. He wanted to go into commercial banking, but he consciously decided that a law degree was, as far as he was concerned, better than an MBA or another business degree. And it certainly proved helpful in his case. Student numbers are a challenge because it is so intense. And working together, Justine Bidiger, who manages our Claussen Center, deserves credit for working with the rest of us to build up student numbers. We have enough for two teams. And they acquitted themselves extremely well over the weekend before Thanksgiving at UIC, University of Illinois at Chicago Circle. So, again, an equally valuable program, and I believe everyone in our community should be very proud of this this fine representation of Kenosha in the outside world.
Very good. Yes, it was great to have Mike Fegley on the program last year
with some of the
students who were part of that program. It's great to hear that they were successful. I appreciated what you wrote recently about the holiday of Thanksgiving and reminding us that it was President Lincoln who declared Thanksgiving to be an official national holiday, and did so, of course, during the heart of the Civil War, when probably a lot of people were looking in vain for things to be grateful for, but there were things still to be grateful for, even in that dark time. But you went on to talk in that column about the kind of leader that President Lincoln was in those challenging times. And I was really struck by, I think it was the penultimate sentence of your column when you wrote, "Lincoln used practical means for transcendent goals with astonishing political skills." Just say a word to our listeners about what you're talking about with those transcendent goals and the practical means that Lincoln employed to try to secure them.
All right. Well, I'll try to be brief, which with this complicated subject, it's always a challenge for me, but with this complicated subject especially, the Union was desperate in 1862. Federal troops had been losing one battle after another overall. In the East, in the West, a guy named Ulysses Grant was winning victory after victory, not just through frontal assaults, despite mythology, through skillful maneuver and an organizational genius, as well as a willingness to fight and fight hard and be aggressive. Lincoln was committed to the abolition of slavery, but his overarching goal was the preservation of the Union. And one Union victory in the East in the fall of 1862 provided him with that opportunity. George B. McClellan, very popular head of the Army of the Potomac, managed to fight Lee to a draw at Antietam Creek in Maryland, and Lincoln seized on that opportunity to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. He also used the opportunity to fire McClellan. The Confederacy was just one of President Lincoln's endless headaches. McClellan, like Douglas MacArthur, felt that he should be running the United States. He considered the president to be an inferior temporary annoyance, and he looked forward to the time when he could take over. He was, in fact, the Democratic Party's nominee for president in 1864 after Lincoln fired him, and Lincoln outmaneuvered him again. But after Antietam, he finally felt he had enough strength to, certainly had enough of McClellan for quite a while, and considered him dangerous, which he was. McClellan was openly insubordinate and said that he should be running war policy, much like MacArthur and Truman. And so Lincoln finally shoved him over the side and was able to do so. The Emancipation Proclamation, which was issued on New Year's Day, 1863, freed all slaves in the Confederate states. It left slavery alone in the Union and in the border states, which were vital to the federal cause and where there was a lot of support for slavery. By abolishing slavery in the South, Lincoln consolidated his always fragile support with radical Republicans, abolitionist Republicans, who wanted to abolish slavery immediately and also burn the Confederacy to the ground. It really was a killing time in American history, as we all know. I mean, really, really bloody. 600,000 Americans in a much smaller population died during that war. Lincoln carefully calculated that he would not only consolidate support among anti-slavery people, he would also maintain strength in the fragile border states and parts of the North, including Maryland, where slavery, and Delaware, where slavery had a lot of support, and Indiana. Anyway, the government of France, the government of Britain, and the Vatican were all very interested in recognizing the Confederacy, because Washington was a nuisance, the United States was a nuisance and a pain in the neck. By making the issue one of slavery in public terms through the proclamation, Lincoln made it impossible for the French, or especially the British, to come in on the side of the Confederacy. The more you learn about the period, his timing in this case and in others is absolutely brilliant. The ability to keep in mind a variety of considerations and at just the right time.
Well, and under circumstances that were so trying. I mean, in many cases, you know, when we are facing such imminent threats on all sides and a desperately difficult situation, it's often when we do our worst thinking. And in the case of Lincoln, he rose to the occasion in such amazing fashion.
Well, you sum it up very well. And the picture, I spent some time looking for the right photograph. The picture that illustrates that blog post is one that is generally regarded as capturing Lincoln's character. And he's very elusive, like most successful politicians, and very, very consciously so. And that one really captures the strength of character, which isn't an exaggeration. We all have our faults. I certainly do. And politicians do. because they're human. And Lincoln did. But the more you learn about him, unlike others, the more you learn about Abe Lincoln, the more impressive he becomes in terms of this overpowering commitment to the cause. Energy. It's phenomenal he got as much done as he did. There was they had the telegraph, and they had messengers, but there was no motor car, no telephone, no mechanized assets available. It's just quite remarkable.
It's a great story.
And it did head off the British and the French, and the Vatican had to tone things down. There was a very friendly correspondence between Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, and the Pope, interestingly enough. And Lincoln managed to short-circuit all of this. It's a very, it's a legal brief, speaking of mock trial. It's a very dispassionate document. He refers to property. He doesn't get into the kind of basic moral concerns that drove him and are reflected so brilliantly in the Gettysburg Address and his second inaugural. And indeed, the administration passed laws, confiscation acts in Congress in 62, and then issued a series of methodical warnings to the Confederacy that we will take your property. This is part of our war powers now, and we will take your property. And that seems cold-blooded, and many people complained bitterly that Lincoln was referring to slaves as property, in effect. But it was all very calculated and ultimately worked. And we can all thank God for that. That war we could have lost,
and
like other wars. That was a war we could have lost, and we the Union, the real United States, and we're all damn lucky that we won.
Absolutely. I want to mention parenthetically that on one of the days that the morning show was preempted because of the impeachment hearings, what I ended up running on my podcast is a longtime favorite interview with historian James Perry, the author of a book called Touched by Fire, Five Presidents and the Civil War Battles That Made Them. And if people are interested in seeking that out, that aired back on the 21st. And so this talks about the Civil War experience, not only of Ulysses S. Grant, who you just mentioned, but four other men who would go on to become president: Rutherford Hayes, James Garfield, Benjamin Harrison, and James McKinley. McKinley was only 18 years old when he enlisted in the Civil War, and each of them had powerful experiences of one kind or another, and this book is just a fascinating examination of all that. So if people are interested in looking that up, it's a great book, and I think an interesting
interview. Thank you. I will seek it out.
So for those of you just joining us, we're happy to have Dr. Art Sear with us on today's morning show. I want to be sure that we take a little time to talk about some of the statements made as of late by President Emmanuel Macron, the leader of France, critical comments about NATO, which prompted, among other things, a testy response from President Donald Trump. And it's, you know, just kind of feels a little bit like some role reversal because, of course, President Trump has had some critical words about NATO himself. But
and President Trump was testy, you say?
I did. Yes.
Oh,
that's yes.
What a surprise!
Imagine that. But your column about President Macron's comments about NATO, I learned a lot. I did not realize France had such a checkered relationship with NATO. Explain to our listeners who have not yet read your column. Just why that relationship has been as complicated as it's been, and why, in a sense, President Macron's comments are not as surprising as they might on the surface seem to be.
Well, nationalism has been particularly important. We're all kind of going crazy with Brexit nowadays, at least I feel I am, sort of, when it comes to Europe. But there are lots of other issues and complicated concerns. National stability in France has been intimately connected, unlike other countries, with a sense of separation from NATO historically. And the pivotal figure and principal figure is Charles de Gaulle, this larger-than-life character. He arrived in London with a couple of his, after France fell to the Wehrmacht in 1940, to the amazement of everyone, including many Germans, by the way. The Free French, those who didn't surrender, who were going to fight to the death, left the country if they could. De Gaulle literally arrived with a suitcase, a picture of his wife and son, a radio transmitter, which was crucial, and began demanding and pressing the British relentlessly and the Americans for support. Both Roosevelt and Churchill found him a very difficult individual, as did everyone. Eisenhower had a very good relationship with him, by the way, which was crucial to the success of the Normandy invasion in 44. De Gaulle became president of France for a little while right after the war, and then he retired. In 1958, France was falling apart, literally. It was impossible to maintain a stable government. They had just lost a bitter, terrible war in French Indochina. They were there before we were in Vietnam. And had 750,000 troops in Indochina, at one point a large percentage of them combat troops, unlike us. And they lost. They were in a bitter, bloody, cruel revolutionary war in Algeria. They'd suffered elsewhere. It seemed like a military coup in France might be possible. At that point, De Gaulle was asked to return. He established a very, very strong executive. He changed the Constitution, created the Fifth Republic, which stays in place. Originally a 7-year term, it's been shortened to 5 for modern leaders, contemporary leaders like Mr. Macron. Tremendous executive power, greater power than the President of the United States. And he brilliantly stabilized and unified France. A big part of that was independence from NATO. In 1966, France left NATO formally. They kicked the headquarters out of Paris. NATO went to Belgium, Castel, outside of Brussels, where they still are. And things were very, very difficult. It was also a very interesting time, especially the intense conflict between President Kennedy and President de Gaulle, which I find quite fascinating in terms of the personalities, basically clashing strategic visions of how the Atlantic Alliance and foreign policy should be conducted. That's all by way of background. In 2009, France returned to NATO. They're a very good partner, a very, very effective and loyal military ally of the U.S. Right after 9/11, in continuing very, very challenging small wars in Africa, the French military are extremely important to this country, to NATO, to the U.N. So that's a bit lengthy as usual, but all that by way of background for Macron, who's echoing. I find it a vague echo and not at all disturbing of this intense French nationalism, which seems to be essential to France's effectiveness since that terrible defeat in 40. It was not only a defeat, but a history of collaboration with the Nazis that continues to echo. Occasionally some aging alleged war criminal will pop up in the news, or a politician will be suddenly discredited or attacked for alleged collaboration. It was a horrible time for France, you know, having to submit and supinely tolerate this German, this really ugly criminal German occupation. It's understandable why the politics would be so disturbed by it.
Right. So you see Macron's statements about NATO. I mean, basically, if I understand his statement correctly, he believes that Europe needs its own organization distinct from NATO.
Yeah.
And that Europe, including France, would be much better served by that than being part of NATO at all. But actually,
yeah, but the Europeans are always talking that way, not just the French. They always talk this way.
About NATO?
About an independent force. Look at it from their point of view. The United States is this overwhelmingly powerful economic as well as military force. And by nature, we have disagreements. And with our current president, if I may speak more personally, it's understandable that they would be particularly irritated. I'm irritated. I think given the current style in the White House, who can blame them?
Why
is anybody concerned? That was the approach of the columns. But a lot of the media, not you of course, but a lot of the media are driven by almost hysteria, not because events in the world are so tough, but because they're in a ruthless, competitive, dollar-driven business. Today, it's dollar-driven, as you well know, more right. than in the time when it was a more stable government-regulated network environment and where newspapers were more stable in major metropolitan areas and even in small towns. Now, everybody's afraid of losing his or her job, and we got to make money, and my boss is on my neck, and so I'm going to scream about France. That's right. My opinion.
Right. So, in other words, for too much of the media, it's about raising alarm about one
exactly.
thing or another,
yeah.
and not enough about the kind of slow, methodical educating of the public that also should be a part of good journalism.
Yes, exactly. And NPR, to be a little calmer and more objective about it, NPR performs a very vital role. I'm particularly glad that the BBC, which I associate with serious news presentation then and now, is expanding its market. Thanks. Significantly to collaboration with you and your colleagues
right.
in public broadcasting.
Yep, they're important.
A fine positive force for serious people.
Right. Let's move on from France to Britain and to Mr. Boris Johnson. And yeah, speaking of raising alarms, you in actually two different columns since you were last here, you have very, very tough words for British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. But what really especially bothers you, and I want to give you a chance to talk about this, is how apparently Prime Minister Johnson enjoys likening himself to the legendary Sir Winston Churchill, whose birthday was just Saturday, November 30th, because my little brother shares the birthday. So,
well, thank you so much.
I'm really
glad to know that. Yeah. Thank you.
So I was already thinking about Winston Churchill even before I read your column, in which Boris Johnson was seeking to draw comparisons between himself and Churchill, and you just think that comparison is pretty much ludicrous. First of all, can you summarize how he is comparing himself to Churchill, how he sees himself as a Churchill figure, and then why you think that makes no sense?
Well, it makes sense politically for him. I don't think the British especially at large find it plausible. He's written a biography of Winston Churchill, one of the more recent ones of an endless stream like Abe Lincoln. And I've read that it's – I haven't read it. The Economist says it's not bad, so I grudgingly admit it's probably worth taking a look at. Like Churchill, he has phenomenal energy and he's very ambitious. However, he's very erratic, very unstable. Churchill could be very temperamental, but he was very consistent later in life in his focus on the inherent danger of the Third Reich and Nazi Germany. At a time when British opinion, when British establishment and upper class opinion in the Conservative Party overall felt quite the other way, there was a consistency to Churchill's purpose. And he was extremely effective, again reminiscent of Lincoln, at building coalitions when it really mattered. He was a truly inclusive leader within his, in political terms, highly divided country in a terrible time. For a year, Britain was fighting alone after the fall of France in May of 40 and the launching of Barbarossa, the gigantic Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in late June 41. The British were fighting alone against the Third Reich.
It's hard to imagine how terrifying that would be.
Yes, it was. And he had a capacity to inspire the public at large, but also build coalitions. By Hollywood standards, to my mind, there's a pretty good film, The Darkest Hour, which describes that period relatively effectively. As usual in media melodramas, Churchill is alone. That was not the case. The British government was seriously divided. And as France was falling, Hitler shrewdly held out an olive branch. The Germans at some primordial level were afraid of the British. And it's one reason why Sea Lion, the invasion of the British Isles, they couldn't bring themselves to do it. And then after the Battle of Britain was won, they couldn't do it. But they were intimidated by the British. Hitler also was not constantly attacking. He was, in his own way, very effective for a long time. He held out an olive branch, and members of the British government were very much in favor of negotiating some kind of peace because of the realistic fear that we're about to be we're about to see the swastika, you know, on British buildings. This is just horrible what we're facing. And Churchill managed to deflect a decision in his inner cabinet, and he went to the outer cabinet, the larger government, which the movie presents pretty effectively. But he also brought with him allies from the inner government, including Neville Chamberlain, his predecessor as prime minister, who had been destroyed psychologically and physically. He died not long thereafter by the fact that his appeasement policy and the Munich Agreement had been cynically thrown away by the Nazis. Churchill always went out of his way to compliment Chamberlain in public, and he did that regularly with others. After Chamberlain died, Churchill was always careful to include his widow in public ceremonies and recognize her as the late prime minister's good partner and important wife. It was very, very calculating. Boris Johnson's like a bull in a china shop. He's constantly insulting everybody, utterly erratic in his behavior, from my point of view. And therefore, I don't think, even if the Tories win more seats in the election this month, I don't think he's going to last.
Right.
But Churchill is really, again, the more you learn about him, for all his faults, which are very obvious and much greater in the obvious sense than Lincoln's, he really was quite brilliant as a strategist, including dealing with these Americans who could be in their own way so difficult, and his elusive absolutely necessary partner, Franklin Roosevelt.
Right, and Mr. John Meacham, who came to Carthage not too long ago, has written a brilliant book about the two of them, Winston and Franklin, talking about their relationship, which eventually was a friendship, but kind of an uneasy friendship. And it's a fascinating thing to examine. That's a book I highly recommend.
Franklin and Winston, that is the title.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm glad you brought that up. Churchill did not go to Roosevelt's funeral in May of 45. FDR was essentially not a very nice man. I do think he was a great president. Eleanor once said, you know, Franklin is not a father, he's not a husband, he's not a friend in the usual sense. She said that publicly once, and absolutely right. Roosevelt treated Churchill very badly at later summits in his effort to develop a close rapport with Stalin. And Churchill did not go to the funeral and then felt guilty about it, of course. And remorseful, but it wasn't a friendship in the usual sense.
Right, not at all.
But the British were brilliant. I mean, brilliant. And Roosevelt, when he saw how the winds were blowing finally, was very much committed, of course, to British survival and took a lot of risk to do that.
Right.
But you weren't a friend of FDR's. Mm-hmm. You could be a friend of Winston's, and he was a faithful friend.
Mm. And so you take to task Boris Johnson for trying to draw comparisons with himself and Churchill.
Other people do it. If you're a good politician, you don't go around.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
The British and we have leaders who are like each other in strange ways. Both Churchill and Roosevelt, undeniably great leaders and essential. Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan are parallel in terms of a different kind of conservative revolution in each case. George H.W. Bush and her successor, John Major, really very, very effective executives, underestimated, underappreciated, rather short-term leaders. And I think Trump and Johnson are alike in some obvious, and it's this strange, you know, beyond the empirical level, there really is some kind of special relationship between the Brits and us.
Interesting. You write at one point about Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson has thrown caution and responsibility out the window while grandstanding and calling attention to himself in a nonstop melodrama designed to get the UK out of the EU, whatever the consequences.
Yes.
So I wish you would be a little clearer about what you think.
Very well.
Yeah, you should stop pulling punches and spit it out forthrightly. Yes.
That's good writing. Thank you for quoting that guy.
It really is.
Yeah.
For those
who
are just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, and here to talk about a wide range of issues. And with just a quarter of the hour remaining, let's talk about some other things. I was reading today about the economy in Hong Kong suffering, at least by the standards of Hong Kong. I think there are other economies that are probably in far worse shape, but the author of this article sort of explores the way in which consumer sentiment, they said, and tourism activity are both very much disrupted by the protests that are still going on in Hong Kong, which may face its first recession in some time.
Yeah,
just remind us about what's going on in Hong Kong and how significant it is, in a sense, to the rest of us.
The communist government in Beijing endeavored to use a really tragic event, a murder of a young woman by her fiancé. He happens to be from Taiwan, as large offshore island, as people probably know, to try to impose harsh new restrictions and facilitate extradition of accused people from Hong Kong to the mainland. Mind you, snatches, kidnappings, mob-style grabbing people who are a nuisance is something that the Beijing government does and continues to do in Hong Kong. It's one reason people are so nervous. This effort to impose more authoritarian rule led to this ongoing, constant, massive public demonstrations in Hong Kong that are involving a large percentage of the population.
What kind of a player is Hong Kong on the global economic map?
Tremendous. It's a gigantic financial center. It's a fascinating place to live. I spent a couple of years running the World Trade Center in Chicago, a very challenging and very rewarding job for me, and very well timed. And on business, went to Taipei, Seoul, the really great trade centers in the world. It's not a realm where we operate so naturally. And as part of that, went to Hong Kong in 1997, just as the transition was taking place. It's a combination of Britain and Manhattan and Las Vegas, and it's kind of wild in many ways. But you have, as in Manhattan, you have a sense of just concentrated financial capital. And that's been a saving grace, among others. It's a big reason why the People's Liberation Army hasn't invaded Hong Kong. It's a big reason why there hasn't been the kind of bloody crackdown that a lot of communists, and not just old guys, there's a very militant, younger generation in the Chinese Communist Party. They haven't done what they'd like to do for that reason.
Interesting. Out of North Korea comes some bellicose rhetoric from their leaders regarding the United States and the fact that the arms negotiations between our two countries have pretty much broken down in an utter stalemate. And what I read is that the government of North Korea is saying it's up to the United States to choose what Christmas gift it gets from us. And it's trying to, I suppose, throw the ball into our court and so on. But when you have words like that coming from a place like North Korea, it's a little more disconcerting than if it comes from somebody friendlier. But remind us, if you would, about what these negotiations are about and to what extent they have completely broken down and why.
Well, the latest wild declaration from Pyongyang, so what? That's life as usual with those people. Since the 90s, North Korea has been developing nuclear weapons. There have been serious things going on, including some rudimentary nuclear tests. And they fire off missiles, which sometimes work and sometimes don't, of increasingly long range. This has been going on and on and on. The fact that the President of the United States went to meet with Leader Kim, his counterpart, the North Korea's leader, not a true counterpart of the President of the United States, I believe was a big mistake. The fact that we've been embarrassed by announcing that an agreement is at hand and then nothing actually happens shows the importance of traditional diplomacy. Mm. One other point that's worth mentioning, especially in the current media environment, is that the North Koreans are very much afraid of us. The armistice in 53 that ended the Korean War, Dwight Eisenhower had promised to do this, and it was one of the first things he achieved in office, has held since 1953. The Korean War was a terrible conflict. I believe it helped get us involved in Vietnam. Undeniably, it made the Cold War global. Hmm. Eisenhower had John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, publicly hint at using nuclear weapons. That's in the public record. The Indian government especially was useful in communicating that to Pyongyang. We had a monopoly at that time, in effect, although the Soviets had an atomic bomb from 49. Stalin had died. It was because of Joseph Stalin that North Korea invaded the South. That's in the public record. What's not in the public record is that we engaged in obliteration bombing of North Korea. There were very few military targets left after 3 years of bitter warfare. Curtis LeMay, the ferocious Air Force commander, said there was really not much left of any military value. What's not in the public record, but if what you can discover if you look at it, is that we started killing everybody in North Korea. Dams were broken. Vast territory was flooded. As far as the eye can see, pictured nothing but water with bodies, including women and children, animals, crops destroyed. The electric power grid in North Korea went down. Mm. What I believe is that Dwight Eisenhower, through intermediaries, of course, this is the real Eisenhower. He told the North Korean leaders, "We're going to kill you all. This will go on forever. Don't you think you finally want to sign on the armistice line?" Mm. It's that kind of temperament that was important to our victory in Europe in World War II. It's quite contrary to the public image of Eisenhower. It's quite real. And that's the way the world really is. And I think it's important to reiterate this kind of point, given the relatively secure and comfortable world we live in today. Right. So we can thank President Eisenhower for crucially leading us to victory in World War II, and we can thank President Eisenhower for establishing stability in the Korean Peninsula. Mm. That's far more important than whatever statements might be getting all kinds of attention from Pyongyang or from Washington, D.C. regarding Korea.
Right. And what you're saying, I think part of what you're saying is that we should not underestimate the legacy of what you were just describing. I mean, that it lives to this day in North Korea in terms
yes.
of how they view us and the way in which they feel threatened by us.
Yeah.
Because collectively
yeah.
as a nation, they still remember what yeah. we did to them in the early 1950s.
Yes, indeed. They've carried out terrible terrorist and assassination acts. Suicide squads still go down from the north from time to time. There are occasional naval armed conflicts between small ships. But the armistice has held since 53. It's quite a remarkable achievement. And again, Eisenhower, characteristically, unlike so many politicians, he put in place a comprehensive set of plans for the development of South Korea. And a stable democracy, pretty wild and unpredictable, to be sure, but a stable democracy, increasingly the rule of law, and one of the phenomenal, and I mean phenomenal, economies of the world now, is in South Korea, and very, very important allies to us. We tend to overlook the South, especially these days. I first became aware of South Korea in a personal way in the United States Army. I can assure you the South Koreans are very, very intense and dedicated allies of the United States, and very, very impressive soldiers, to put it politely. They maintain 50,000 troops in South Vietnam throughout our long war there. They had almost as many combat troops as we had. You don't have support services to speak of in the ROK Army, at least back then. And they did that only because of commitment to the U.S.
Hmm.
They're really important friends of ours. And if you want to be serious about foreign policy, And even if you don't, you should keep in mind the country that's not in the headlines day after day.
Right. Speaking of strong economies, Janet Yellen, who is the head of our Federal Reserve, I think the first woman to be head of the Federal Reserve.
Yes, indeed. Important to keep mentioning that. Absolutely.
Yeah, has said that she feels right now some discomfort with the state of affairs with our economy. I think she cited in particular spillover from what sort of amounts to a trade war with China and some of the effects of that and so on. But she believes that we have a higher than normal or higher than typical risk of falling into recession at some point, that by no means is it inevitable. But just wonder what your assessment would be of kind of the health of our economy at the moment.
I defer to people who know what they're talking about, like Janet Yellen. Things go up. What I do know, buddy, is things go up and they go down. So I think there will be a recession. I just don't know when, but we're not going to have prosperity forever. A lot of people talked that way in the 1920s, and a lot of people talked that way in the 1960s. And when good old Bill Clinton, President Feelgood, was in office, he talked that way. The business cycle has ultimately not been abolished. But since the Great Depression, the strength of our system has certainly been confirmed.
Right.
Look at debt ratios. When total public debt gets to be more than 100% of GDP, that's cause for concern. Since 1940, every 20 years, our gross domestic product, insofar as you can measure it, and it does mean something, has doubled. Just extraordinary. It's the productive power of this economy that means that we can run these big deficits. As usual, what business people do, if they're smart, look at not just debt, but debt-asset ratios, and there we're doing pretty well. And it's not, however, just because of the current occupant of the White House. There are other factors at play.
Very good.
So it's not just him.
Right.
That's a joke.
Right.
That's also true.
A joke and true. On that note, I think we have to draw things to a close. When you come to us next, we'll take some time to talk about the Democrats who are contending for the opportunity to run against President Trump in the next election. And, of course, we should talk about this move to impeach the president. And we'll see where that is when we have you back in January of next year. But in the meantime, I want to appreciate you, express my appreciation to you for this wide-ranging conversation that we've been able to have today and all of the other conversations we had throughout 2019. It's always a real pleasure and honor to have you here on The Morning Show, and I thank you for being part of this program.
Well, it's a pleasure for me as well. It's also part of my job. This kind of work is very much what Tom Clawson had in mind. When he and his wife endowed the chair I'm fortunate to occupy at the moment. He was too smart to tell us what to do, but he was good at keeping an eye on things, and for all I know, he may still be doing so. But he appreciated this dimension very much, believe me.
Well, it's great that we can have you here, so thank you again. Dr. Art Seer Clawson, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, Director of the Clawson Center, my guest today on today's morning show. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll have several different interviews, including one with a former deputy director of the U.S. Forest Service, talking about some of the concerns that he has about the possible rollback of regulations involving something called roadless forests, which has been traditionally one of the most effective ways to preserve our national forests. And the possibility of that that regulation being altered is a source of concern for him, and we talk about that tomorrow. On Thursday's morning show, you'll hear a conversation with Jennifer Sassaman, who is from the theater department at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, talking about their current production of a play called Silent Sky, which tells the true story of a woman astronomer and actually a couple of female colleagues who worked at the observatory at Harvard, and some of the important breakthroughs and discoveries which they were responsible for right around the turn of the last century. And on Friday, several different conversations as well, including a conversation with one of the leaders of the National Geographic Society, talking about the way in which they are celebrating the legacy of women for the next calendar year. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. It's archived at WGTD.org and also available as a podcast via Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, Spotify. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. We're approaching 9 o'clock.